I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. hit a grim milestone yesterday. More than 100,000 people diagnosed with COVID-19 are in the hospital, and the death toll is the highest ever. 2,760 Americans succumbed to the coronavirus on Wednesday. Dr. Robert Redfield, head of the CDC, said yesterday that the months ahead are going to be the most difficult time in public health history of this nation, and that's a quote. While it's easy to feel hopeless and helpless about what lies ahead, there are things we can do to help mitigate the spread of the virus. Wear a mask, be physically distant from others, and when a coronavirus vaccine is approved, get immunized. President Obama said yesterday on Joe Madison's radio show, if Anthony Fauci tells me this vaccine is safe and can immunize you from getting COVID, I'm absolutely going to take it. But there is vaccine hesitancy, and many report they are reluctant or even refuse to wear a mask. So today in Radio Times, how to get people to think and act in pro-social and altruistic ways. And joining us is Damon Santola. He's a professor of communication, sociology, and engineering at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directs the Network Dynamics Group. Also, I should say, author of a forthcoming book titled Change, How to Make Big Things Happen. Damon Santola, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. How do we get people to think collectively versus individually? And I start with that question because I was thinking about smoking. You know, getting people to stop smoking is largely an individual thing. They're doing it for their own health. Or wearing seatbelts is a way of individually making sure that you're safe in your car if something terrible were to happen. But when we talk about coronavirus, it's about the individual, but it's also largely about the community. How do we get people to think collectively?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would say that what we're ultimately interested in is less how people think and more how they act. When we look at people's, you know, decisions to wear face masks or, of course, decisions to get vaccinated, ultimately, they may believe various things. And people can have different, you know, personal beliefs about why they're doing it or communalistic beliefs about, you know, the good of the neighborhood around them or the people they know at work. Or it could be because of religious beliefs. But sure. The decision to do that ultimately is largely influenced by the people around them in ways that may not be obvious to people making the decision. And so one of the things that we think about in our research is even if people aren't aware of, you know, how their beliefs are affecting their behavior, ultimately by presenting them with new social influences, their behavior can be changed. And that's an important way of sort of conceptualizing the choice because ultimately it may be a choice to protect yourself that is informative of people's decisions. So if I, you know, am wearing a mask and sure. make a suggestion that someone else wear a mask, it can come off as the fact that I'm worried about myself, right? And I'm telling them to wear a mask because I'm worried that they might be a threat to my health or my family's health. But if I communicate to them that, like, I'm more worried about them and the fact that I might be a potential source of infection for them and their family, and there's a certain sense of obligation I have to protect them, that actually changes their receptiveness to the idea of wearing a mask.
Well, that raises a whole host of questions. One is, I guess, the power of peers or people within our peer group, but also the kind of messaging that has come from, if not the President of the United States, but public health officials, Fauci and others, about what we are supposed to do or not supposed to do in the face of this virus. How do you see the messaging coming from on high?
Yeah, one of the things, I mean, the President Obama quote about if Fauci decides to, you know, recommend vaccines, I'll get a vaccine, is sort of perfect because, you know, it's the question of who's paying attention to which news sources, right? And so there's a lot of diversity in people's media diets, and there's also a lot of segmentation in, you know, how people are interpreting the information coming around them. So when I interpret this sort of through a social networks point of view, one thing we typically think about is the networks between people or the networks from media to people are like these pipes, and they're sort of disseminating information. And the kind of classical belief had been, well, when you have a new piece of information, that's supposed to change your behavior. We've seen time and time again with, you know, now with beliefs about climate change, but also with beliefs about face masks and about the dangers of this pandemic, that just because people have access to accurate information doesn't mean they make, you know, the appropriate behavior or even believe that information. And so social networks are often doing this sort of other work of like filtering the information people see and determining whether or not they believe it, and sometimes filtering their sort of perspective on whether or not they should react negatively to it. So there's a phenomenon in psychology called motivated reasoning, which basically means when you see a new fact, how do you interpret it? Do you believe the fact? Do you doubt the fact? Do you question it? Or is it actually a motivation for you to become more retrenched in your own, you know, private bias? And so this happens a lot with the new public health information about COVID. It's if you have a particular political commitment or an historical or cultural commitment that creates suspicion around the media sources, then a more aggressive media presentation of that, you know, present of the pro-vaccine argument or the pro-face mask argument actually makes you less likely to be responsive to it. And so one of the fundamental questions is, well, how would you go about creating a dialogue between communities that made people receptive to this kind of information and actually made the information more likely to change people's beliefs ultimately about what they think? Yeah.
Well, and that was my question, because I understand the conundrum that you have set up. But I mean, I think we can all, maybe we can't, I'll put it out there, we can all believe that taking steps, I mean, some are, from my perspective, simple steps like physically distancing and wearing a mask, right, that is a good thing to do to try to stem the spread of this virus. I do want to talk to you about vaccines, but let me start there, because that seems, at least on the face of it, like such a simple decision. But for some people, that is a violation of their civil rights or their ability to be a free person or to make decisions on their own. How do we address that?
Yeah, and the interesting question to sort of think about is, where did the notion of a civil rights violation come from in this context, right? It had to sort of emerge out of a pre-existing conversation that then sort of, you know, because it doesn't make obvious sense, right? A face mask isn't an obvious violation of your civil rights. So it's built on other sort of differences in the community, and it amplifies those differences. So one related study we did that it's going to kind of illuminate this is we gave a group of Republicans and a group of Democrats, this was 2,400 people, images from, you know, the history of data on Arctic sea ice. This is data collected by NASA, so it's a neutral organization. And just ask the basic question, if you look at this time series, what's going to happen next? And what you see is this sort of massive downward trajectory in Arctic sea ice. And so it's this kind of plummeting line. And the question is, you know, if you predict 15 years out, where's the line going to be next? And what you see is like the vast majority of Republicans look at that line and say, oh, Arctic sea ice is going to be higher in 15 years than it is now. And the vast majority of Democrats look at the same line and say, obviously, it's going to be much lower than it is now. And so the point is, just by giving people the accurate information, it doesn't at all determine what conclusions they're going to draw from that information and what inferences they're going to make about what it means for their own behavior. And the, you know, the sort of the way or the strategy that we use to sort of adjust people's thinking and hopefully not only improve their sort of, you know, receptivity to people from the other side of the fence, but also their understanding of the actual, you know, real climate trends, is to put them into social networks where they can talk to each other. Hmm. But one interesting thing is, if you put them into social networks that, you know, cross party lines, if that interaction structure is highly centralized or basically gives one person a lot of power, then those networks are not very effective. In fact, they can amplify biases. What's really effective are networks that are much more egalitarian. So you kind of distribute power throughout the conversation. And when that happens, the dynamics really reflect what's called the wisdom of the crowds or collective intelligence, where you get sort of people learning from each other in a decentralized way, where like small pockets kind of figure the answer out and then influence everyone else. And there's this really important lesson about the way that the structure or the sort of pattern of connectedness in a population affects not just the dissemination of information, but how that information is interpreted. And when you have one strong influencer at the middle of a community, they can really amplify the bias in that community. And so that really goes to the question of face masks and the question of, you know, is this pandemic a hoax and are vaccines going to kill you? And so that's ultimately what's at stake, is can we provide a way for people to have this conversation and to learn and to be, you know, good democratic citizens and interrogate the information the information coming from their government. Nobody wants the citizens of a democracy to just blindly accept government advice, right? We want the citizens to think about it, reflect on it, talk about it. And the question is, how do we do that in a productive way? And the people's social networks are a huge part of that.
Well, that's so interesting because, I mean, I think we do rely on experts. I mean, I'm thinking of Fauci and others that, you know, as Obama said, if Fauci tells me to do it, I get this vaccine, I will do it. But what it sounds like what you're saying is that in if you're trying to change people's minds, it's really more the power of the peer group to influence how people think about whether it's a mask or a vaccine, which is raises a whole host of questions about the kind of public health messaging that we've been getting.
Yeah, and I think that so the work I'm doing and the book that's coming out talks almost exclusively about this difference between spreading information about public health or about climate change or even about, you know, any kind of like new product or idea that's challenging, that's difficult to believe, that maybe goes against the grain of what you already think or cuts against the biases that exist in your community. Those kinds of communication strategies really don't work if it's just kind of information propagating. It really has to be a strategy that takes into account the fact that people are going to talk with their friends and neighbors about this idea. And that's really going to frame whether or not they believe it or whether it kind of, like I said, retrenches their existing biases and makes them even more resistant to it. And we saw that happen with face masks, where it became kind of a label of political pride that you wouldn't wear a face mask, right? It became emblematic of your sort of loyalty to some sort of, you know, ideological commitment. And that's something that no one could have expected, or you certainly wouldn't expect if you were just taking it as an information diffusion problem. Yeah.
Well, as you mentioned, when you get people together and perhaps people that think differently about some of these issues, that you can see some persuasion and some mind changing. But that seems like such a rarity. I mean, we live in these information silos and we don't often interact with people who are sort of on the opposite side of whatever opinions we seem to have.
Yeah, that's such an important point, because so much of the question about, you know, how we inform people's conversations in their social networks and how that improves or reduces the quality of their thinking about important public health topics and important topics in the rest of their lives has to do with this sort of intuition that if we could just get people to talk to each other, we would solve all the problems. So that's not true.
Really?
If you put people together, if you put people together in a network and you put lots of like political slogans in their interaction space, let's say on social media, it winds up amplifying their biases. They wind up approaching each other as enemies, and that winds up making them less receptive to the messages coming from others. So the conversation space and the kind of way they interact needs to be really carefully curated so that interaction is actually a really productive and engaging interaction instead of like one that creates resistance. And the other side of it, which I think is potentially even more interesting, is that echo chambers aren't necessarily bad. I can bring that up later. Yeah,
you certainly can, because we have to take a very short break. That's sure. Damon Santola from the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about persuasion, how to get people to wear things like face masks or even to get vaccinated in the face of the coronavirus. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just do a quick recap about what we're talking about on today's show. Getting a vaccine not only protects you, but also protects the community. Wearing a mask often protects the individual, and it also protects the community, people that we come in contact with. Also, self-quarantining, social distancing, much of what public health experts are telling us during the pandemic is actually good for the society as a whole. And yet we've seen a lot of resistance to wearing masks. People report they're reluctant to getting a COVID vaccine. This hour, we're talking about how to get people to think and act in more pro-social and altruistic ways. And again, Damon Santola, our guest, professor of communication, sociology, and engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. He directs the Network Dynamics Group, author of the forthcoming book, Change, How to Make Big Things Happen. And joining us by Skype is Erez Yoeli. He's a research scientist at MIT MIT's Sloan School of Management, where he directs the Applied Cooperation Team and studies altruism. Erez Ueli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me out.
You're very welcome. Let me just finish up something with Damon that we were talking about right before the break. And you were talking, Damon, about when you get people together who are not necessarily on the same page on some of these issues that we've been talking about, if not persuade them, how do we talk to them? How do we interact with them in ways that can change people's minds? To Damon?
Yeah, so two of the strategies that we found really effective is to put them, yeah, hello?
Yeah, you're there. Go ahead, Damon.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm not sure we can hear. Okay. We're gonna go back to Damon Santola. Erez Ueli, I'm glad you joined us because I have a bunch of questions to you. We'll get Damon Santola up and running in just a couple of moments, hopefully. Let me ask you kind of a broad-based question. As we deal with this sort of ongoing, frankly, worsening pandemic, I think many of us are we feel exhausted, worried, frustrated, depressed. And I'm just wondering how that affects the way we think about our own behavior, the behavior of others. What's the kind of state of mind you think that we're all in today?
Oh, man, I bet.
It's a big one. I apologize. Go ahead.
Yeah, I bet it's a big mishmash. I mean, I think there are plenty of folks out there who are looking at the situation and are thinking to themselves, this isn't that fun. And there are plenty of people for whom they're like, it's not that fun, but that's okay. This is what we have to do. And then there's also some people who are like, this isn't that fun. And people keep trying to tell me what to do, and that's not cool. And probably it's some mix of all of that for everyone, but more of one than the other for some. And some people more focused on their own discomforts, and some people more focused on the fact that this is something that we have to kind of come together to beat.
Yeah, and all of that feels very true to me. But is it harder for us under those circumstances to act in an altruistic way or to be more pro-social because we feel, I mean, in some ways, sort of survival of the fittest, that it's every man or woman for themselves?
You know, the evidence on this is mixed, and there's a really interesting literature on this. And if you're somebody who's really interested in this, Joe Henrich, in his most recent book, which is about the weirdest people, I think the title is The Weirdest People in the World or something like that.
Interesting.
He talks about this a fair amount, and he says, if you look at natural disasters, big disasters, natural disasters, wars, things like that, they actually typically have the tendency of bringing people together. Even though you might intuitively think that these things would get people to focus on their own welfare more because there's so much danger and so much risk. But he actually finds that if anything, there's evidence to the contrary, that during these periods, people tend to cooperate more. There, in fact, tends to be a return to religion during large disasters, which also helps with cooperation. And he presents some very nice evidence on that. And he has a couple of postdocs working with him, one of whom also focuses on this question.
Oh, that's fascinating. I mean, do you think we're kind of in a war footing with this pandemic?
Most of the discussions I have about this are about how people aren't doing what they're supposed to do. But like, I think it is good to pause for a second and realize, holy smoke, like, how awesome are all the things that we did do? Like, we came together. Most of us are actually doing the things that are being asked of us. Most of us are largely staying home, even though that sucks. Most of us, when we meet with others, are meeting with them in responsible ways. Most of us are wearing masks. I mean, we're seeing mask wearing rates climb, even though that's been, you know, a huge controversy. Nonetheless, they're doing that. Most of us are pretty eager to get a vaccine. We've been successful in cooperating and getting the vaccine in the first place. I mean, there's just so much. This was unimaginable 100 years ago. I mean, compare this to the behavior of people during the 1918 influenza, and we're kicking butt. It's great.
That is such a rare piece of good news, and I'm glad that you raised it. But do you think we've spent too much time talking about all the bad stuff that is happening, the people who aren't wearing masks, who don't want to get vaccinated, you know, all the things that undermine what you just said there?
Yes and no. I think that you can we have good evidence of this, in fact, that you can overemphasize the negative stuff, make people think that that stuff is more common than it is,
right,
and therefore undermine the cooperation that's going on as a consequence. Because, you know, if you're seeing is pictures of people at a party or not wearing a mask or other things, you're going to start to infer that it's really common behavior and think, oh, well, I'm not expected to do the good things myself, and so stop. And that can indeed happen. On the other hand, there is a benefit to making it clear that these behaviors aren't okay,
right,
and to calling them out. That's how we enforce social norms, is we are engaged in a bit of naming and shaming. And by naming and shaming, we kind of get people in line a bit. And so we kind of need to strike a balance. We, on the one hand, want to send the message, hey, most people are doing the right thing. And on the other hand, occasionally it's okay to say, hey, you didn't do the right thing. That's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, think about the criticism that Governor Newsom got, and then the mayor of SF got. These guys are telling people to do all sorts of really tough stuff, and then they're ignoring it themselves. We definitely should have called them out on that.
Well, absolutely. And I believe in calling out public officials when they do things like that. And this is in the news in the last couple of days, and a number of Democrats, it should be said, who were telling people, you know, stay home and don't get on an airplane and fly somewhere, and don't go out to dinner and take your mask off and be shoulder to shoulder with the people that you're dining with. And lo and behold, that's exactly what they did. I mean, that's hypocrisy at its highest level. But I wonder about sort of calling out regular folks, the kind of naming and shaming of, you know, that person that you might pass on the street. Is that helpful? Does that really get people to be more altruistic, to think in more pro-social ways, or just make them angry?
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, I think for a lot of folks, they don't want to be the person who is seen breaking the rule. If they're already somebody who kind of views this as, this is what we're supposed to be doing, and the people around them are mostly view it that way, then they're, you know, the threat of being shamed is actually a meaningful concern for them. And so in that sense, yeah, like this can be effective. But there's also, we do have this problem, and I caught the very end of your discussion previously before the break.
Yeah, and he's coming back in about 20 seconds. But go ahead, Eris.
You know, we have these subsets of society where we haven't quite established combating COVID as a social norm. And when that's the case, naming and shaming is not going to work. So you first kind of have to do the work within those communities to get this to be recognized as to get things like wearing masks and doing these other COVID evasion behaviors to get them recognized as something that's good in the first place. And then once they are, then maybe we can rely on naming and shaming. But it's a little premature to do that.
Sure. Let me just quickly reintroduce you and get our other guest back in on the conversation. That's Eris Ueli. He's a research scientist at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He directs the Applied Cooperation Team. And one of the things he studies is altruism. Also with us is Damon Santola, professor of communication, sociology, and engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. He directs the Network Dynamics Group, author of the forthcoming book, Change, How to Make Big Things Happen. And we have you back, I think on a telephone, Damon Santola, and I'm sorry about, sorry we lost you there, but thanks for coming back.
That's fine, absolutely.
Okay, we're doing it the old-fashioned way. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I was talking with Eris about, you know, how do you persuade people to change their mind, and something that you and I were talking about as well, and the idea of sort of how do you create a social norm that allows people or gives people permission or makes them feel good about making a pro-social decision. Can you speak to that, Damon? How do we create that?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I think in general, there's sort of two big ways of thinking about social norms. One is that people are basically inclined to do selfish, self-interested things, and then we need kind of some kind of incentive to force them to be cooperative. And the other way of thinking about social norms is that people are basically just coordinating with each other. They're kind of looking at their peers, and they're making decisions that make them feel comfortable. And that comfort level isn't really based on a sort of a need to be selfish or altruistic as much as it is just kind of getting along with the folks around them. And this is where kind of the pockets of people that are most influential become really significant, because if they're surrounded by people who are all doing one behavior, then doing that behavior, it seems normal, right? And if people who are not like them or they don't interact with frequently are doing a different behavior, then that actually reinforces the fact that the people who are like them are maybe giving them a clearer signal of what they're expected to do. So it really comes down to like what your social expectations are in your community. And that's where the power of social networks becomes so important. I think before the break, we were talking about this question of echo chambers.
Right.
And there's a really clear, there's an intuition that a lot of people have that echo chambers are, you know, fundamentally a bad thing. So they keep people separated across the aisle, but also they lead to, you know, increased bias in people's sort of perspectives on, you know, relevant political topics, whether that's climate change or face masks or vaccination. And one of the things that we found that's most striking is, and this goes to the point of social networks, is that, yeah, when echo chambers have one big influencer at the center of a network and they're sort of talking to a lot of people, then heavily biased opinions tend to dominate because they're like easy to understand and they reflect everyone's existing beliefs. And so those tend to sort of take over in a community and drive everyone away from the other, you know, the other communities, and you get more polarization. But when you have, as I mentioned before, these more egalitarian networks where right. people can kind of talk to each other and kind of flesh out their opinions in a slightly more deliberative way, what you wind up getting is each of the groups, and this is a study we published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, each of the two independent groups, Democrats and Republicans, within their echo chambers, both echo chambers actually moved toward each other and became less polarized, and both groups sort of moved towards the sort of correct understanding of problems. And whether we looked at immigration reform, we looked at gun control, all these sort of hot-button political topics. And what's so interesting is that it really has to do with the kind of conversation that people are having, more than, you know, whether that's, you know, located within an echo chamber or
sure.
a cross-party
sure.
conversation.
Aris, let me go back to you, and I'm thinking about, because we wanted to focus on masks, and it should be said that most people are wearing masks most of the time, so we're talking about a small subset. But it's interesting that it seems almost regionalized, and I'm picking up on this idea of community. If you look around, say, Philadelphia, probably Boston, where you are, you probably see most people wearing a mask. But there are parts of the country where we don't see that. Does that tell us something about the power of either conformity or reputation or community?
Yeah, I think it definitely reflects all of those things, in that wearing a mask is, it's not like a huge ask, but it's a bit of a pain. Right. And you're not, like Damon was saying, you're not going to do it unless there's like a good reason to do it. And if everybody else around you is doing it, then and you feel like it's expected of you, then you will. And if the folks around you aren't, then you won't. And in some communities, for whatever reason, whether it's political or whether it's that the communities are sufficiently small where mask wearing may not make actually enough that much of a difference or that much sense. It always makes sense indoors, but like, you know, the kind of mask wearing that we're doing, which is like quite strict, might
right.
not be necessarily in some of these smaller communities. In those cases, maybe the norm is quickly eroded and you basically get nobody wearing a mask.
Damon, I want to read an email from Mark who says, what do your guests think about almost President Biden's approach, which is to say that wearing a mask is a patriotic thing to do. And it's interesting to contrast President-elect Biden's approach to masking and the current President Trump's approach to masking, almost like polar opposites. You talk about the power of peers, but it seems that there is a lot of influence and power from these high-level people as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting observation. So one thing to think about when you think about influencers and how effective they can be is whether or not a message that completely contravenes what people believe in the community they're talking to would be effective, right? So right. if Biden just stopped wearing a mask altogether, right, it's not as if the vast numbers of followers or constituents for his presidency, would all of a sudden stop wearing masks, right? Mm-hmm. It's a message. His message resonates with his community, and also hopefully extends a little bit farther beyond that to people who are unsure what to do. And that's really the goal, is to sort of extend the message. But by and large, it's not as if an influencer can do whatever they want. I mean, you have to remember that what an influencer is someone who's like massively connected to a vast number of people who are, you know, essentially in the periphery of this sort of connected, you know, social network in this country. And those people also have opinions. And so if the influencer does something that's vastly unpopular, it's not as if everyone's going to start doing that unpopular thing. So influencers have to be aware that they're also being watched and scrutinized for the things they do. And so their messages have to be consistent with that, with, you know, in essence, the base in a political context. And so I think that when we think about messaging, one of the other things to think about is that when people interact with inside groups, groups are a little bit weird. They behave slightly differently than people one at a time. And so shaming is a really good example of this, where you take a person by themselves and shame them. That can be really effective at changing their behavior. Individual psychology is pretty clear on this. But when you shame people in groups, there can be these weird backfire effects, yeah, where they wind up actually doing the behavior more frequently and also more flagrantly as a result of basically collective response to the shaming strategy. And that's, I think, an important thing to sort of think about when we're talking about these sort of population-wide changes, because we're really looking at, you know, a collective process of people deciding together to do this thing. And so the strategies that are going to be effective have to be effective for collectives.
And that's, the, of course, the power of the group. I want to pick up on that with you, Evers, but I do want to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about a whole host of things, but essentially how to get people to think and to act in more pro-social and altruistic ways in the face of the threat of the coronavirus pandemic. And again, our guests are Damon Santola, Erez Yoeli. And you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and I'm talking with Erez Yoeli. He's a research scientist at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He directs the Applied Cooperation Team, and one of the things he studies is altruism. Damon Santola, also with us as well, professor of communication sociology. Communication, Sociology, and Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania, directs the Network Dynamics Group, and again, author of a forthcoming book, Change, How to Make Big Things Happen. Erez, let me just pick up on what Damon was talking about right before the break about this power of the group to influence behavior. Can you speak to that? I'm also interested in, you know, whether carrots are more effective than sticks, or whether fear is a motivator to get people to change their behavior, to engage in more altruistic and pro-social behavior?
I agree with Damon's comments before on influencers, and I agree that groups will behave differently from individuals. Basically, once the group sort of kicks in, you often have exactly the opposite incentive. So when it's just the individual and everyone within their group is behaving one way and expecting one kind of decision, and they're behaving another way, then that group can kind of get the individual in line. The group has ways of sanctioning the individual, ostracizing them, etc., that can get them in line and really encourage them to behave in the desired way. But once a whole group of people is kind of there to support each other as they're going up against another group, that starts to feel like a very different dynamic. So I'm with Damon on the fact that you have to beware of attempting to shame entire groups. That's quite likely to backfire. As to the question of sticks and carrots and fear, the way that I typically think of it is both of them can work. And the question of whether you want to use a stick or a carrot is one of practicality. So sticks can often be very effective. You can by shaming somebody, you can have a huge impact on their behavior. But a lot of times, that's not the thing that you want to engage with. If you're let's say you're a company, shaming your customers is probably a pretty terrible idea because you're going to discourage people from wanting to engage with you in the future. And I think that that's often the case. The government is often in a similar situation where they don't want to abuse their power by shaming people. They want to have a more positive relationship with folks. So a lot of the times, even though I might prefer to use a shaming strategy because I might feel like it would be more powerful in this particular context, I'm somewhat constrained when designing a intervention to encourage pro-sociality because my partner doesn't want to have that kind of relationship with the people that whose behavior they're trying to change. And recognizing that, I often will instead stick with the carrots.
You stick with the carrots. Let me read an email from Thomason. And Damon, I'll put this to you. He says smoking cessation campaigns include severe warnings about the effects on lungs and secondhand effects on in a consistent message. Would such methods work with COVID, do you think? We get kind of gruesome and graphic, actually.
The graphics, right? It's a really interesting question. It has to do with the fact that COVID has become, and COVID prevention has become so politicized. And so, you know, when you think about groups, you have smokers and non-smokers. It's, you know, it's a behavioral group and you can kind of switch. But to the extent that your, like, self-identity is wrapped up in being a smoker is questionable. But political ideology is a different thing in this country. It's thinking about, you know, your commitment to the state of democracy, but it's also emotions. It's, you know, political loyalty and all these other things get, you know, invoked that don't really show up with smoking and non-smoking. We ran a study with smokers and non-smokers published last year where we tried the same strategy I was discussing that we used with Democrats and Republicans looking at data from climate change. And the same basic dynamics work. If you look at smokers and non-smokers and show them cigarette labels and ask them about the dangers of cigarette smoking, what you get is what you'd expect, which is that the smokers have a pretty biased perspective and it's really different from the non-smokers. And you put them into groups and they talk to each other. And interestingly, the groups that were most effective were where they could see that they were talking to smokers and non-smokers. And they wound up not only coming to a much better understanding of smoking risk, but actually having like a much more favorable opinion of the out-group than what they started with. That like, hey, smokers are actually pretty reasonable once you talk to them, and the smokers wind up coming around to a sort of a more reasonable perspective. And so I feel like that strategy, which has worked in now in the context of Democrats, Republicans talking about climate change and immigration and smokers and non-smokers talking about smoking risk, seems to be a fairly generically effective strategy for getting people to sort of coordinate on what the new expectations are for, you know, their understanding of a topic and what, you know, ultimately is a more accurate understanding of the topic. And so those strategies seem to be, I think, surprisingly effective because they're so minimal. There's no explicit incentive to sort of believe one thing versus another thing or do one thing versus another thing. It's like, it really is kind of a faith in the sort of this democratic process of people figuring things out through this kind of deliberation.
That's fascinating. Here's, let me do a quick follow-up, if you don't mind. I was reading about a study of an anti-smoking study that was aimed at teenagers. And when they tried the graphic imagery and stuff like that, the teens didn't seem to really connect with them.
Right.
I think because they mostly feel really, invulnerable. But when they were told, you know, cigarette companies are lying to you, they think you are a fool for smoking, that seemed to have a different kind of effect on their behavior. Can you briefly, because I do want to get James to join our conversation, but briefly respond to that? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, you can see what that framing does, right? The original framing is like, you're an individual. Here's these risks for you. Are you going to pay attention to them? Are you going to be like good or bad, right? And, you know, certain people are just going to resist that and react to it. The other one is, hey, there's two groups of people. There are these predatory organizations and there are these, you know, people being taken advantage of. And you're one of these, you're in this group of people. And then, you know, how do you feel about that? And there's all of a sudden like a membership boundary and you're like, hey, we don't want to be taken advantage of, me and my peers. And I feel terrible about this. And, you know, I don't want to be on the side of exploitation. So there, it's a way of positioning their experience and really their decision making that, you know, invokes a certain kind of identity. I wanted to say, and if you want to,
you know what, if you don't mind, Damon Holt. Yeah, Damon Holt. I just wanted to give Eris a chance to respond to that as well. Eris?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, I find myself agreeing again. I would add to that one tiny twist, which is, one of the things about smoking is that it's really a lot about image and about signaling something to the people around you about the kind of person that you are. And one of the things that's making that second message so effective, I think, is that it takes smoking and instead of making smoking something that you do because you're tough and, you know, if anything, the first message is kind of bolstering how tough you are for like ignoring the future and like, right, you know, doing this thing anyway and throwing hazard to the wind. And it takes that and it completely undermines it. And it says, oh, like, actually, ha, 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 look at you, you sucker. And so I think perhaps an additional reason on top of the reasons that Damon mentioned might be the fact that it's actually undermining the signal.
Right, right. Let me get James. We got a lot of people that want to weigh in on our conversation today. Let me get James to join our conversation. And James joining us by phone. Nice to have you with us from Radio Times. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking the call, Marty.
Sure.
I was so glad to hear the program today. I actually just had a conversation with the only other Democrat that works with me in this small trucking company we work for, and they're like serious Trumpers, you know. And they a little while ago they announced that we're having a Christmas party in a bar, and so to me and the other guy, they're Biden supporters. I hate to draw political lines, but really that's what it's coming down to. To us, it's like, you better be kidding me, man. You know, it's a no-brainer. Why congregate in a bar during a global pandemic? You know, and so we both decided in a brief conversation that there's no way we're going to this thing. And I mean, I don't know if that rises to the level of a political statement. Maybe it does, but to me, it just seems like a no-brainer. I detect a certain amount of obstinance in the fact that they're having it in a bar and like pushing the envelope because they're Kool-Aid drinkers, basically, a lot of them, not all of them, but so it's incredible. It's just incredible that, you know, that they would go ahead and do that.
Well, James, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times because you've raised a really interesting point. And actually, Eris, let me toss this back to you because Damon, I've got another question for you. But Eris, what do you say to James, our trucker listening on the road?
I mean, he's right. It seems like what's going on here is it is along political lines. I think there's a bit of reactance going on where you're basically saying, no, we're going to do this anyway because that's we're not going to be told what to do. And this is a good way of signaling that that's the case and that that's the kind of group that we are. And obviously, like the fact that you're reacting to that because you're not really part of that group makes a lot of sense. And I think your reaction of saying, no, I'm not going to be part of it sends a very clear signal both to that group and to the other people around you of what your values are and where you stand. So all that makes sense to me.
Damon, I'm curious about, especially talking about COVID, if people don't know anyone who has been sick or tested positive or who have died from the disease, and I have to say I know all those three groups, does that change then how they're going to either mask up or how they might look at a vaccine if they don't really have this personal connection, painful personal connection to this virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, emotional intimacy does a lot of work in thinking about these kinds of changes. I mean, we also saw this with changes in beliefs about, like, same-sex marriage, right? People who had more contacts who were, self-identified as homosexual and were pushing for that became more receptive to that social movement. And that was, like, one of the mechanisms that allowed it to become sort of a majority-accepted perspective in the U.S. in just, like, 20 years. And so the kind of direct emotional connection to people who are suffering, of course, makes people more sensitive to the issues. But it's not a guarantee. I mean, the striking thing about motivated reasoning is that you can bring a truckload of facts to bear that are you know, compelling and immediate, and they can nevertheless be ineffective. And so it really has to do with the ways in which people are, you know, engaged by a community around them who's saying, okay, we're going to make a decision to, you know, behave differently or respond differently to this, you know, to this immediate pandemic, and also to believe that it's not a hoax and to believe that this cause wasn't something else. And you can see this with any real immediate health threat, that it can always be reinterpreted. I mean, one of the issues around vaccine hesitancy, and one of the reasons it's been around for so long in the U.S., is because there are lots of alternative explanations, right? You can blame vaccines for, you know, autism, because autism tends to show up after a vaccine start. And so there's this intuition that there must have been, you know, some reason to blame autism. So that's an immediate emotional reaction to something that's related to your family. But the reason that you sort of believe that about vaccines has nothing to do with, like, evidence about vaccines. It just has to do with, like, a set of beliefs that you hold that make that a compelling way of interpreting it. And I think that that's true even for people who have intimate friends and family suffering. There are alternative ways of kind of skewing it. And so that can be compelling for some people. But I think ultimately you look to your community to understand the things that are weird and all the uncertainty that we're faced with, and where people get certainty from and a sense of self-confidence and ultimately safety in the world is by, you know, looking at their community and getting a sense of social proof that they believe things that make sense and they can do things that make sense. And that's where, you know, I really sympathize with James, who called in, because, you know, there are a lot of people who are experiencing that, where they're seeing these sort of differences within their own community, and they're trying to reconcile, like, what is it that makes sense? And it seems so incomprehensible that it becomes kind of an unintelligibility. You say, this seems crazy. What are you doing? And it's very hard to understand that within that, you know, with that group of people, this seems not only to be reasonable, but also to be like something you're proud of. Yeah. You're making
and
it
Damon,
to,
yeah.
you know, articulate. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I'm sorry to do this. Let me jump in. We got so many people. I want to read a couple of comments. We're almost out of time. Kyle says, I find many people practice social distancing and wear masks and also support our current president's skepticism that there is much risk from the virus. I'll just leave that out there. Stephen says, if it were made clear that should severe lockdown, quarantine, travel, et cetera, restrictions become necessary, anyone who could prove that they had received a complete course of COVID vaccinations would be exempt. Implementation of this policy should be sufficient to motivate people to become vaccinated. I guess kind of, you know, saying that if you get vaccinated, then you can engage in these behaviors. Let me ask you, Erez, about what if we just made masks mandatory? I mean, wouldn't that in certain ways just solve the problem?
Probably yes.
But
you have to be sensitive to whether, I mean, every law is put into place in a context, and sometimes there's a lot of other things that you want to worry about, even if that particular law might cause good things to happen in this particular situation. And so I can understand if people are not that keen on making masks mandatory, because that might set bad precedents for other things and therefore cause a reaction.
How about for you, Damon? We got 30 seconds.
I just wanted to reflect on an example. It seems a little far afield, but I think it's really instructive in this case, which is that, you know, during the 60s and 70s, a lot of countries were trying to get contraception adopted. And it was a similar kind of thing. It was heavily resisted in a lot of countries for, like, religious, but also for traditional reasons. And the country that was most effective was Korea. And what Korea did was something different than every other country, most of which tried, like, forcible, mandatory, and also, you know, shaming strategies to get couples to adopt contraception. What Korea did was they started, you know, basically targeted women's groups. And it was women's groups within local villages that started adopting it and created a social norm that spread from, like, group to group and created these really high levels of adoption. And Korea, as a country, reached all of its policy goals in less than 20 years, which is unprecedented. I mean, it's never been rivaled globally. It's incredible. And it was this kind of bottom-up network strategy, and you compare it to all the other nations at the same time. And
yeah,
really
I hear you, and I hear the closed music as well, so I apologize for that. That's fascinating. Damon Santola, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Erez Yoeli, thank you for joining us as well.
Also my pleasure.
You're very welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.